Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Good morning, I'm Christopher Purdy, delighted to welcome everybody to The Book Show, All Sides Weekend Books, to use the official title. We get together once a month to discuss what's new, what's important, what's hot, what's in books and in reading, and there is no show without my guests. They are Chris Hickey, who is the Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Library System. Chris Hickey comes every month with quick picks. Those are the books everybody wants to read, and you're going to tell us how to skip the line, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Michelle Herman is here, Professor Emerita of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University, an author, an advice columnist, a dancer. And Michelle Herman just brought me a gift. She brought me copies of two of her books, including one of the loveliest novels I've ever written that you should all read, called Missing. Missing by Michelle Herman, also A New and Glorious Life. Thank you, Michelle Herman. Cassie Rose is here. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is indispensable for anyone who loves books, thelongestchapter.com. There is no show without Cassie Rose. That said, I'm going to talk to Chris Hickey because you told me that the book that we're going to discuss at the top of the show, kind of to get it out of the way, and I mean that in a compassionate sense, sure, has about 800 holds on it from the library.
This is probably the most talked about book, the book right now. It's also number one on the New York Times bestseller for nonfiction.
And it is?
So this is Nobody's Girl by Virginia Roberts Giuffre. So this, timely, as if you're following the news. So this is a very raw, very painful read. So she's telling her story so that other victims of sexual abuse can feel seen. So if you are following the story, in April, she did die. She is suspected suicide. She worked with journalist Amy Wallace for 4 years to tell her story. And she wants people to understand that victims of human sex trafficking are made, not born. So she wants to tell how she got there. So she chronicles horrific abuse by her father and his friend. And all of that happened before she was even in middle school. She describes how she confronted him in front of the family and they did nothing. And that sent her on a path that eventually put her in front of Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein. She didn't escape, and she shares that because she thought most people were like him, so why bother leaving? Her father was a maintenance worker at Mar-a-Lago, and he got her the job there, and that's when she met Ghislaine Maxwell. So close to the beginning of the book, she describes a visit to the Louvre, and this is, you know, past all this where she's testifying, she's in France testifying, and she goes into a room in the Louvre, and she thinks, I've been here before, and it brought back awful memories. But what she said to herself in that moment is, I'm going to reclaim this room. And I'm going to have different memories in this room. That was very, very important to her, that she was with Ghislaine Maxwell, who also abused her. So she speaks candidly about Andrew. He's not Prince Andrew anymore.
Mr. Mountbatten Windsor.
Maxwell told her that she would be a princess, and it was her lucky day that she got to meet a prince. She speaks a lot about Andrew in that one. She also talks about...
He is never going to be able to say ever again, I didn't know or I didn't do it.
I don't think... Okay. I don't see that.
Not because
possible.
Of this book.
Well,
no.
Yeah, at least.
So she also talks about an unnamed prime minister, and she won't say who, but she had feared that he would kill her. So as a child, she had a horse named Alice. And so she has this interesting comparison between horses and women, you know, saying that they are both vulnerable prey animals. And that was an interesting, she talks about that quite a bit at the beginning of the book. I'm reading this book, but it's going to take me a while. I'm going to take breaks because it is a very intense and very detailed.
Do you think it's important that the book was written?
I think so. I think it's always important for someone to tell their story, particularly that she didn't want other people to, she wanted other people to feel less alone, other people to have their experiences seen.
Did you also get the sense from her words that Maxwell and Epstein knew who they were looking for?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, very much so. And like she said, they're not born, they're made, and they know what to look for in vulnerable people.
The book is called?
The book is called Nobody's Girl, by Virginia Roberts Gouffre.
And it is?
It is a quick pick.
And my God, there's a line, though.
There is a very long line for it.
Can I ask how many copies you bought, the library purchased? Do you have any idea how many copies?
Oh, gosh, over 100.
Okay.
I don't remember the name off the top of
my head.
And
even with over 100, there are 800 people waiting to read the book.
Yes. Wow. And I want to say something about if you're waiting for books, right now we are dealing with a situation. Our main vendor, Baker & Taylor, has gone out of business, and we did 90% of our business with them. And our collection services team is fantastic, and they are working with other vendors to fulfill those needs. So we just ask the public to please be patient with us, but we are working very hard to get books into everyone's hands.
The indispensable Columbus Library. Everybody out there, be nice, because they do a lot for the community. Thank you for discussing this book. I'm sure it was hard for you to bring that up, but again, I think, as you say, it is the book right now on the market, and we wouldn't be doing the show properly if we didn't bring that up. Michelle Herman said that she had brought some comfort books, so I'm going to go from that and ask you to comfort us right now, if you wouldn't mind.
All right, I brought a whole bunch of books that I have found tremendously comforting and that I feel comfortable recommending. None of them are new. Well, that's not true. Two of them are sort of new. The first one is a great favorite of mine, Sue Hubbell's A Country Year. It was written in 1983, and I didn't learn about it until the late 80s when I was going through some real difficulties and someone recommended it. I was very skeptical. I'm not a reader of books for comfort normally. It's a nature book. It's called, the subtitle is Living the Questions, and it's nonfiction. And in it, Sue Hubbell tells the story. She dispenses very quickly with the kind of premise, which is that after a long marriage, she and her husband divorced, and she moves to the country. She's in a pretty isolated rural place. And the book is divided into sections of the seasons. And if I tell you that I don't read nature writing ever, and I'm suspicious of people telling us how to live, this book really changed the trajectory of my life at the time that I read it, to the extent that I think over the years I have probably bought 50 copies of it and given it to people in all kinds of difficult situations, post-divorce, going through chemo, being widowed, whatever it is.
Really difficult situation.
Yeah, it's a meditative book, but it's not boring. Don't ask me how she pulled this off. But anyway, A Country Year by Sue Hubbell. It is available in the library. It turns out I went looking for my copy on my shelves, and evidently I've even given away my own copy, so I need to buy it again. But I got it from the library so I could bring it here. Can I, before we move on, I have a quick pick question for Chris.
Mm-hmm.
So if you order 100 copies of something and a lot of them are going into circulation, but there's one on your quick pick shelf, if someone takes out that book, what happens? Like, it's not a quick pick anymore, or are there
no,
copies?
No, it's still a quick pick. So they are in the catalog. They're coded differently.
Okay.
And so that's why they aren't pulled to fill holds. And so when someone checks it out, it's a circulation, but it doesn't take away from other people.
So does another copy of it get put on the shelf immediately?
Yes. We buy copies that are for circulation, and then we buy copies that are specific to Quick Picks.
And then sometimes on the shelf, the Quick Pick shelf, you'll have two or three copies of the same
book.
Mm-hmm. You just have to get there.
You just have to get there.
Yeah,
and
I was just thinking about a book that's this much in demand. Yeah. So I just have to keep haunting those Quick Pick shelves daily.
Absolutely. Cassie Rose is here, WOSU's book critic. We've been comforted. We've been troubled. Help us out. Put your arms around us with a book.
I'm going to start with a book, Christopher, that we had talked about actually yesterday in a conversation. It's by Barbara Pym, and it's called The Sweet Dove Died. And in terms of comfort, I will share with you, a friend of mine told me that, who reads a lot of fantasy books and science fiction, whatever, she said to me that she felt like, for me right now, that my fantasy world is to go back to like the 1950s and the 1960s and 70s. And interestingly, even after she had said that to me, I was in a parking lot somewhere and someone cornered me and asked me what I was reading. And at the time, I was reading The Sweet Dove Died. And she brought up the fact that her book club finds that they are more and more going back to 20th century books because it's their comfort zone. Because even if you read about World War II, you know what has happened.
Right.
You have that sense of comfort. So anyway, Barbara Pym. The Sweet Dove Died was one of her later books. So she started out writing in the 1930s. Her first book took a long, long time to get published. And then in the 1950s and 60s, she was able to, she published like five or six books. And then at the end of her career in the 70s, The Sweet Dove Died and Quartet in Autumn became two very popular books for her. And she's sort of legendary for the British woman and the manners and the elegance, but also a lot of comedy, too, or at least in that British comedy, like an Evelyn Waugh type of way. And with The Sweet Dove Died, what I so loved about it was her character, Leonora, who is elegant and who loves her life of Victorian objects that she fills her home with. And she goes to an auction, and there she meets an auctioneer, an antique owner, shop owner, and his nephew, and they take her to lunch. And this 60-year-old shop owner, kind of gets infatuated by her and thinks he will start asking her out, which he does, but she's more interested in his nephew, who is 24 years old. So there is this fun and kind of funny, but also very charming story in the very beginning about how she is becoming friends with James, because it's comforting to her. She wants to be cherished. She wants to be have a companion. So it's not sexual in any way. And then, of course, things get interrupted because he gets a young girl named Phoebe, sort of seduces him. And then he also goes to Spain on a trip and he meets Ned, who is a professor, and comes back to London with him. And Ned, he very much wants him alone with him. So what I loved about this book, again, that the drama takes off is when Ned comes back with him, and Leonora has to deal with some issues of the fact that Ned is trying to pull James away from Leonora. Again, Barbara Pym is just, she puts you into this world where you feel comforted, you feel like you're engaged in a very good story and another time, but she also is very, very good at nailing her lead characters and keeping to their very Britishness. And so even at the end of this, as much as Leonora becomes somewhat of a bitch, you still love her because she's remained true to character, which is important.
And she's British.
She's British, yes.
We have to take a quick break and come back. We're going to talk more about comforting books. I've got one, too, I want to talk about. But let's take a break, and we'll be back shortly. Don't go away.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
We are back, All Sides Weekend. This is The Book Show. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, Michelle Herman, and Chris Hickey. And I want to vote. I want to put in my vote for a comfort book. You said England, 1950s and such. In This House of Breed.
Oh, by Rumor Garden.
By Rumor Garden. In This House of Breed. I read it every year. I'm a little strange. I mean, I still binge watch Call the Midwife on PBS, and my wife is like, would you please, with those nuns and those women screaming in labor? Oh, my God. No, but this book, In This House of Breed, which is about...
Actually, it's been a long time since I've read it.
It is about an enclosed order of nuns in England in the 1950s. And you would think it's all very serene and lovely. Forget it. There's all kinds of drama and consternation going on. But there's just something nice about, I don't know what even though, comfortable about it. So Rumor Garden in This House of Breed, you can write that down, B-R-E-D-E, if you want a comfort book.
I'm interested in the fact that you're rereading the same book every year.
I do.
I've stopped rereading. I feel like I'm too old. There's too many
well,
books.
There are some books I won't reread. We have to talk about The Making of Americans someday. I'll tell you about that story. But this one, you know, when things look bleak, I take this book off the shelf, and it just sort of centers me in a lovely way.
It's a beautiful book.
I can't
book.
Explain it. I
it's
can't
a beautiful
really.
Book.
I'll give it a try. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, Rumor Garden.
Okay.
Yeah, she's long deceased, I think. I read it decades ago,
but all I know, whenever that her name comes up and the title of that book, I should probably reread it and pull it up because I've got it on my shelf.
Yeah.
It is an extraordinary and beautiful book.
Chris Hickey's going to give us a quick pick that's happy. There are
happy moments in this. It's fantasy, and it's so if you
again,
take us out of our world and plop us into
okay,
another
well,
one.
Okay, well, we've been comforted, so you can get us riled up again.
this is not an upsetting book. This is a beautiful book. So it's called The Everlasting by Alex E. Harrow. And if you read her Starling House a few years ago, she's a fantastic writer. I don't know where her stories are going to go, and I'm always wonderfully surprised. And this story is, there are two themes in this book. One is gender norms, and the other one are the myths about country, the myths about the world and the way things are. So this centers around a knight of legend, and her name is Una. And she's a legend. She was a real person, but also a legendary person, you know, years in the future. She's studied, she's celebrated, and so is the queen that she served. And the other person in the story is a man named Owen, and he's in the present time. And he's a frustrated academic, and she is his area of study. And he's about to give up, and someone sends him an ancient book that has a different kind of story about her, and it changes everything that he knows about Una. And then the next day, that book disappears, and in its place is an address. So he goes to this address, and he is face-to-face with a very high elected official in their government. And she tells Owen, Una has lost her way and you need to get her back on her path. He doesn't know what that means. And he opens the book and it's blank. And so the official stabs him in the hand and his blood on the book takes him back in time to Una. And they're face to face. And what he and Una don't know is that this happens over and over and over again. And they are doomed to repeat it until they find their memories.
Is it like Groundhog Day?
In a way, yes.
Is that a Bill Murray movie?
A little bit. Yeah, you're like, okay, we're back here again. But it's always a little bit different. We always learn a little bit more. Things are not what they seem. And it is a love story because they do fall in love over and over again. But it's a little bit different. Una is strong. She's a warrior and she's physically strong. And Owen is gentle. And sweet. So the gender norms are a little bit different. And Alex E. Harrow does that on purpose. And when she was researching Joan of Arc to write this book, because Joan of Arc is an inspiration for Una, she discovered that When Joan of Arc was executed, one of the reasons is because she would not give up her male clothes. Mm-hmm. And she thought that was fascinating and incorporates that. There's also dragons in here, which, and it's a very different take on dragons.
Well, did you get frustrated, though, when you read over and over again that they fall in love? So it's no longer a mystery that they're going to fall in love.
But how and what's going to happen?
They don't know they're in love, do they?
They don't know.
But if it's Groundhog Day and they, you know, so now
they don't know. So it's different than Groundhog Day where Bill Murray knows, like, oh, we're here again. They don't know they're here again.
Oh, okay.
So it is very much. And then, yeah, I won't say anymore because I don't want to give away what happens. But it is a beautiful love story and just really great world building and time travel, and she just tells a story really well. She has four books, all wonderful.
Alex E. Harrow, is that
yes,
right?
Okay. Yes, she was just at Columbus Metropolitan Library last week, and it was wonderful to hear her speak.
All right, the Everlasting. A recommendation from Chris Hickey, who is Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Library and brings us quick picks from the library. Michelle Herman, what do you got for us?
Okay, more comfort.
Okay.
This is a book. This is Roger Rosenblatt's Making Toast. Roger Rosenblatt is a regular contributor to the New York Times. He's written plays and, well over a dozen books. This is the book of his that I love most, by far. It's going to sound grim. The premise will sound grim. And instead of telling you the premise, I'm going to read you the opening because you know I prefer to read your writer's work rather than talking about a book. It's a very short book, and it begins, "The trick when foraging for a tooth lost in coffee grounds is not to be misled by the clumps. The only way to be sure is to rub each clump between your thumb and index finger, which makes," sorry, I don't have my glasses on, I'm trying to read, "which makes a mess of your hands. For some 20 minutes this morning, Ginny and I have been hunting in the kitchen trash for the top front left tooth of our 7-year-old granddaughter, Jessica. Loose for days but not yet dislodged, the tooth finally dropped into a bowl of Apple Jacks. I wrapped it for safekeeping in a paper napkin and put it on the kitchen counter, but it was mistaken for trash by Ligeia, Bubby's nanny. Bubby's, James, is 20 months and the youngest of our daughter Amy's three children. Sammy, who is 5, is uninterested in the tooth search, and Jessie is unaware of it. We hope to find the tooth so that Jessie won't worry about the tooth fairy not showing up. This sort of activity has constituted our life since Amy died on April 8th, 2007, at 2:30 p.m., 6 months ago. Today is June 9th, 2008. The day of her death, Ginny and I drove from our home in, I don't know how you say this place, Quag? Q-U-O-G-U-E?
Quag in New York?
Quag, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Ginny and I drove from our house in Quag on the south shore of Long Island to Bethesda, Maryland, where Amy and her husband Harris lived. With Harris's encouragement, we have been there ever since. How long are you staying? Jessie asked the next morning. Forever, I said. And so this book is the story of Roger Rosenblatt and his wife Ginny's life as the live-in grandparents of these three children and essentially serving as a kind of substitute parent, second parent. And it is bizarrely, again, comforting. It's sweet and it's funny and it's poignant and it has a kind of, I guess what I'm attracted to in these books, in both this and A Country Year, is the idea that in the face of really terrible things happening, really feeling like you can't go on, not only going on, but having a beautiful life. And there's a follow-up to the book that is also quite good, the name of which I've now forgotten, something about kayaking. But this book, Making Toast, by Roger Rosenblatt, is really a joy to read. I laughed when reading it. I cried kind of cathartic tears. And I highly recommend it. This is a 21st century book. This was published in, I think, 2010 maybe, something like that. So that's my second comfort, but Making Toast by Roger Rosenblatt.
Thank you from Michelle Herman, Cassie Rose.
I'm going to go with a nonfiction book. It's called Ghosted, A History of Ghost Hunting and Why We Keep Looking by Alice Vernon. I reviewed this book, and which was not a kind of book that I would typically review, but the publisher had sent it to me, and I do try and challenge myself to break out of my bubbles, especially of literary fiction. And I was absolutely fascinated by this. Alice Vernon is, and most of the instances are in the UK, but she goes through, you know, why it is, you know, we look for ghosts. So she starts in the early, it's like the early or late 1800s, and with seances, and each of the chapters go with, one is seances, one's haunted houses, poltergeists. Anyway, she finds out in the very beginning with seances that there are two sisters that live in a house that is haunted by a Mr. Splitfoot, I think is his name. And he seems to be knocking on the walls and communicating with them. And so they communicate back. And in that experience, they then essentially come up with a seance, a format for it. Again, this is probably sometime in the late 1800s. And what we would call today, what happened is it went viral because other people then took it up, their formatting. And attending seances became very popular until it didn't, which got to be the early 1900s because people sort of cottoned on to the frauds that were taking advantage of it. And also a lot of professionals were debunking what was happening. But then it became popular again during World War I because a lot of families in England were losing their sons and husbands who were never coming home from the trench war and dying and being buried in Europe. So it became very important to these families to be able to connect. And they did it through seances. Now, what Alice Vernon does is that she then goes on to a next type of format, like she will go and talk about haunted houses, or she will then talk about poltergeists, which I absolutely loved. And then always throughout this, she brings in her personal experiences, like she trained to be in a professional society of the people that monitor the ghost hunters, and also how one time she was wanted to know about haunted objects. So she ordered a haunted doll on eBay and got it to the office, took it out of the box, just put it on her desk, and then its eyes blinked. You know, that clack, it just goes down. And she, you know, even when you read that, you get a little uncomfortable and startled, at least I did. And she had to take a moment and say, all right, I was expecting this. So in other words, she didn't say that she pulled out the instructions and read the instructions that said, well, its eyes are going to blink. But she goes down the path of saying that our perceptions change when we expect something. She also tells about, it brings up into modern day technology about, and tells a story about how they're on YouTube. Someone was in a haunted house or a haunted hotel, I can't remember. And they see two, at the end of the corridor, they see two twin children standing next to each other. Well, then from a different angle of the camera, I mean, it was reported on local news. It was a big idea. It was Stephen King and, you know, all of his. There was the Kubrick movie about
The Shining.
The Shining, yes.
So they bring that up. But then another angle, and down the way, someone finds out that it's really two fire extinguishers hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. So she's got a lot of liveliness in it. She's got a lot of history and research in it. And, you know, you come through this book, and at moments I got frustrated because I wanted the grand moment of, yes, here is this ghost or this real thing. But, you know, it doesn't happen because the professionals come in and say that, no, they debunk it. And I realize then, well, that's the whole thing that's going on with ghost hunting and why people are looking, because we don't know yet. It's like why we continue looking for life on other planets. And it's until it's just going to take that one moment because we don't know what we don't know. So it's a very good book and one that I enjoyed a lot called Ghosted by Alice Vernon.
Recommendation from Cassie Rose. This is All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Cassie's blog is important to anyone, and it's a great read as well, to Who Loves Books, thelongestchapter.com. And I'd like to hear another quick pick from Chris Hickey and the Columbus Library.
Well, here's a good transition, because this book is Nicholas Sparks and M. Night Shyamalan. So they see dead people. So M. Night Shyamalan, he did The Sixth Sense with that famous line, you know, I See Dead People. And Nicholas Sparks is the romance writer. And they collaborated on this fun book. And if you like them, you're going to get the things that you love about both storytellers. So good romance and some good jump scares, some thrills in there. So it's about a man named Tate. And he is just released from a psychiatric hospital where he was treated for depression. His beloved sister had just died. And on her deathbed tells him that she can see dead people. And it runs in the family. So after he is released from the hospital, he goes to Cape Cod, where he's going to design a house for his friend. And he stays in a historic bed and breakfast run by a woman named Wren. And they fall in love. And there's a twist. And I won't tell you what it is, but there's lots of secrets in the town surrounding this woman. And people who read it are raving about it. So this is a hit. So how did these two seeming very different storytellers come together? Well, their people put them together. And so they had 6 weeks to come up with an idea to pitch. And they did that. And they chose M. Night Shyamalan's idea. And so then they got together. They hammered out the details of the story. And Nicholas Sparks wrote the novel. And M. Night Shyamalan is writing a screenplay. So this is going to be a movie. And Jake Gyllenhaal is already tapped to be Tate.
And Jake probably can afford to buy the book and doesn't have to get, quick line for the quick picks.
Yes. Yes, he does. He will not have to wait for a quick pick.
The quick picks from the Columbus Library. Before we go to break, I just want you, because I haven't asked you yet, just to review what that is at the
yes,
library.
So quick picks. And you know what? I didn't say the name of this. This is called Remain, a Supernatural Love Story. So that is the title of the book. So quick picks are the hot books, the books that we have long hold lists for. And so we have additional copies that are in our building that don't fill holds. And the idea is that if you are on the hold list, you can come into one of our buildings. And if you see that on the display, you can check it out and skip the line.
And they're all loaded on the same day, right?
Tuesdays is the release date in publishing. And so that's when we will often put things
system-wide,
out.
All the branches.
System-wide. Every branch has quick picks. And
same
every
ones.
Branch gets the same ones.
Okay. Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. Don't go away.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
We are back, All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, the book show here with Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library, with Michelle Herman, Professor Emerita of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University, and Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. And let's go back to Michelle.
And more comfort.
Yeah.
So this book, 84 Charing Cross Road,
I knew her. She was a friend of mine.
Go. So do you know this book, Cassie?
Oh, absolutely.
So when I was thinking about books that have comforted me over the years, this book was written in 1970, and I first read it as a 15-year-old when it came out. It's a slim book, and it's just the correspondence between the American writer Helene Hanf and a British bookseller. She initially writes to him asking about a book, and they have this beautiful correspondence. I don't know what more to say about it than that, honestly, that it's just, it feels so good. And right now, I thought this is a book to read right at this moment.
You're absolutely right. Helene Hanf, who I knew quite well, we were friends in New York. She was 50 years my senior at the time, and she's long since passed away, was a very quintessential No nonsense, in your face, New Yorker. And she's writing to these British booksellers, you know. Right, she begins right after the Second World War, writing to them. And it's you're right. You'll read it in 25 minutes, and you'll read it again if you haven't read that before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, another book of Helene Hamp's you shouldn't miss. You should read this book if you haven't. Underfoot in Show Business.
Oh, no, I haven't read that.
Which was her first book, and it's about trying to break into the theater in New York during the Second World War, and it's hysterical, and will ring true for you. You were born and raised there, so it'll ring true really for anybody who wanted to do something incredible that people said you couldn't do, you know. And she never quite did it either. I mean, she was 60 years old when 84 came out, and she'd been writing for 40 years, and nobody cared. And this book,
and it was made into a lovely movie
and
too.
Bancroft
playing her,
and Anthony Hopkins played Mr. Dole. Yes.
I want everyone, all the young people who've never heard of this book, to read.
You have to read 84 Charing Cross Road by Helene Hamp, H-A-N like Nancy, two F's. Thank you, Michelle, for that, for bringing that back. I appreciate that. Top that, Cassie Rose.
Yes, I loved 84, and I read it as a child to a teenager, and loved it so much that as an adult, I had to go out and buy myself a first edition of the book. So anyway, but thank you. Yes, I am encouraged to reread that book now, to pull it off my shelf. So I have a book here. It's nonfiction, A Flower Traveled in My Blood, the incredible true story of the grandmothers who fought to find a stolen generation of children. And this is a difficult topic, but it's an inspiring story, and also because it's about the grandmothers. So it takes place, the difficult part of it is the dirty war in Argentina and the disappeared. So what happened is that I'll just start with how the book begins. And that is that the author focuses on a woman and her husband who have come to Argentina. Their Jewish family has their generations that have come to Argentina. They're raising their daughter, and their daughter, who is, you know, brilliant at school, and she ends up getting involved with the Montoneros, who were the leftist group in the Perón dictatorship. And then Perón went, I can't remember what happened to him, but anyway, another dictator comes along. And during the dirty war, they are disappearing people that are disagreeing with the government, so the leftist movement. And so in the story about their daughter, she's actually moved on. She's married. She has a toddler, and she's pregnant. And her husband owns a toy store and is working there. And the military come in, and they take him, and then they swing by the apartment, and they get her and their toddler, and they take them away. And the mother frantically is looking for them. And so the author takes that family story and uses it at a thread throughout the book. But essentially, what the story is about how all the mothers came together, and then the grandmothers came together and protested in the square in Buenos Aires in front of the presidential palace. And they, because the ministry and nobody was doing anything to help them to find their disappeared children and the disappeared grandchildren, because the women who were pregnant were giving birth in captivity, the women were being disappeared and their children were being given away. So the heart of the story is about the grandmothers. And I will tell you, they are wonderful. And I can show here a picture in the end papers of the grandmothers who are protesting. And I will tell you one scene, for example, they are in the plaza, and there is an American official that is coming to talk to the dictator, Vidalia, I think was his name. And so now we have U.S. journalists there. And one of the journalists, is CBS, I think it was, is talking to the grandmothers. And the secret police come in. They grab her pad of paper. They grab her recorder. They grab her. And one of the grandmothers just leaps towards him, grabs him on the collar. Another one is leaping on his back. Another one is grabbing, you know, the woman, throwing her in a taxi and saying, take her to the U.S. Embassy. I mean, those are the grandmothers that you are now dealing with, these determined women who could not be stopped. And where this So you get their individual stories, but you get history of Argentina. You also get how, in their determination, they, for example, work with a geneticist in the United States, because how do they find the grand paternity connection to the children that have been stolen and that they are looking for? Because they have success stories. And as they begin to successfully locate them, how do they prove that they are their grandchildren? And so you get the story of the geneticist in the United States, who actually is the one who found the DNA for breast cancer heredity. This is back in the 1980s. So you get that kind of history. The way the book is written, I'm telling you, it's like it's a page turner. You get to the end of a chapter, you just want to keep on reading, because it's like narrative journalism, the storytelling, how she brings you into the lives of these women, these grandmothers who are late middle age and who are doing this at great risk. And it's between 1976 and 1883 of when the disappearances happened. But they are still looking today. There is a list at the back of the book that is as from February 2025 is when it's the last it was updated, of those who have been found. And then there are those grandchildren that they are still looking
for. Still missing.
Wow. Yeah. And if you go to the blog, my blog, thelongestchapter.com, and you scroll down to the very end, you will see a picture of the grandmothers that I included. It is about them. It's inspiring. They are determined. You feel hopeful. You are cheering them on. And I can tell you, I was amazed at how these are women who are just, or people like us. They are just everyday people. They are not, you know, the kind of people that, I don't know, that are politicians or magnificent people you would say, well, that's not me. They're us. And they became determined. They're smart. And they did it out of love and just out of family. So that's the other part of this, is that we see us, we see grandmothers. And you can say, you come away from that and think, if they could do this, well, then I can do something too. Because again, they did it at great risk for their lives, but they knew in numbers, and also the fact they were grandmothers, that probably that the government couldn't come after them. In the very beginning, the government did infiltrate when they were just what they called the madres of the plaza. And they had someone who come in, they thought it was a boy who had lost his brother. Anyway, and so there were some consequences. But after that, they became much more forceful.
There was a movie made about in the 80s about that called The Disappeared, which is about the mothers and the grandmothers who gathered once a week in the Plaza de Mayo in mobs and just stood there.
That's, you know, it.
That's,
yeah,
it.
This is
they
it.
They just stood there like this. Mm-hmm. They had their signs, but they were just, there were so many of them. And they it was just powerful. And there are newsreel footages, you can find it probably mm-hmm. on YouTube, of them. The women are just, you know, they have their purses and they have their whatever, and some of them had children with them, but they just stood there, you mm-hmm. know, and in silence sometimes. And just, it was unnerving in a great way, very powerful.
Yes, and they would wear white scarves,
yes.
which was symbolic of a diaper.
Right, yes, mm-hmm. yes. Tell me the name of the book again and the author.
It's called A Flower Traveled in My Blood, The Incredible True Story of the Grandmothers Who Fought to Find a Stolen Generation of Children, by Haley Cohen Gilliland.
Wow. Cassie Rose recommendation here on All Sides Weekend, the book show. And Chris Hickey, give me another quick pick.
All right. E. Lockhart, who wrote We Were Liars, has a new book that is part of that universe. So We Were Liars, if you don't know, it was popular when it came out, and it exploded again in 2020. When the influencers on TikTok got a hold of it. So it has been popular several times. So in that story, there's an incredibly rich family, the Sinclairs. They have their own private island, and a tragedy takes place on that island. In We Fell Apart, it's happening at the same time. This is a different island. And she was inspired to write another book in this universe, because there's a TV version. She was working on the TV show. She visited an unfinished mansion on one of the islands on Martha's Vineyard, and was inspired to create this wooden castle, which is where this story takes place. So it's about a woman named Matilda, and she discovers that her father is a famous painter named Kingsley Chillo. And he invites her to visit him in this home. And when she arrives, he's not there. And his partner, June, who's a very odd artist, is there, her son, and then two other teenage boys. And so she stays there, hoping her father returns so that she can meet him. But something is just off. And as it is with We Were Liars, there's unreliable narrators. So we're not getting the full picture of what's going on. But she wanted to write a story so that there are other people reacting to what happened in We Were Liars. So what are the rumors that are circulating about this family? So this kind of touches on that too. And so we learn more secrets about the Sinclair family. She calls it her most romantic book of the series because it is very fairy tale inspired. There's a painting that Kingsley has made that is of the Sinclairs with like a Cinderella type of theme. There's another one that's Narnia inspired, Scrub from The Voyage of the Dawn Trader, who sheds mm-hmm. dragon skin. So that's another. So there's very much, it's very like a little bit lyrical and romantic in this fairy tale world. But there's a twist and nobody's telling the truth. And that is what makes these books so much fun. And so I highly recommend it. We Fell Apart by E. Lockhart. You do need to have read We Were Liars. You don't necessarily need to have read Family of Liars, although you could. But it's fun. It's a fun, quick read.
Fun escape, a little fantasy here. And that's from Chris Hickey. And we're running out of time, but I want Michelle Herman to give us one more comfort book or whatever choice.
Okay, you'll get two for the price of one. One of my favorite 20th century writers, Lori Colwin. I think I've talked about her before on the show. She writes wonderful novels and short stories. And she lives kind of as the answer to the question, does anyone write stories with happy endings anymore? I always would suggest her to my students. But her two books about food, home cooking and more home cooking, are the most fun, sweetest books. They are short essays about adventures with cooking, and each essay contains a recipe or two. And I have made all the recipes in both books. And they're recipes for comforting kinds of things like succotash and the famous Katharine Hepburn brownies and shortbread. But the essays are amazing. She has one essay about like ruined meals and an essay about a boyfriend who cooked for her and he'd never cooked before. And because the recipe said brown the meat on both sides, he kept turning it over for an hour, browning the meat on both sides until he said, it says brown. It doesn't say what color brown. And they're laugh out loud funny. They're delightful. They will make you feel better. And then cooking the recipes and then will make you feel even better.
And I want to ask you, this is not book related, but you are continuing your dance career. Talk about the ballet that's coming up.
Oh, I would love to. So Fili Palaki, who is simply a genius, was my first ballet teacher, and I've been studying with them now for 8 years. They have created their first short ballet. The working title is Piazza. I suspect that will be the final title. And it takes place in a town square, which occurs in every ballet, pretty much, and also is a gesture toward protests today and Fili's home of Florence, where, in Italy, life is lived in those town squares. And it's just, we're deep in rehearsals. I'm spending most of my time rehearsing for it. It's beautiful, and they made it on 36 of us, adult dancers, age 20-something to 70-something. And it tells a kind of story. We're dancing it to Baroque music, which
I was going to ask you about the music, yes.
Yes, we're dancing to Baroque music. The music is gorgeous and very familiar. And it's very classic ballet. There's a death by magic, but then she comes back to life.
When is it and where?
It will happen. I can't tell you the times yet. Well, I can tell you the tentative times. It will be December 6th, which is a Saturday. And there will be a performance, we think, at 2 p.m. and at 4 p.m. And it's going to be in the Harmony Project space, which is right next to the Capital Area Humane Society. So just off Morse Road behind Menards. There's lots of parking. And I hope everyone comes to see
Come to the ballet. And with that, I've got to say goodbye and thank you to Cassie Rose, WOC book critic. Thank you to Michelle Herman, who's going to have to go to rehearsal for the ballet, and to Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library with Quick Picks. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Chris Johnson, for making radio. Thank you, Marcus Charleston. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been The Book Show, All Sides Weekend Books on 89.7 WOSU NPR News.